The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
Our overachievers, type A personality, where we like to control everything. Entrepreneurs, always trying to be the best at everything, always trying to be better every day. And then it gets to a point where it gets overwhelming, and that's when the stress level like starts going sky high, red zone, basically. And when you realize, okay, you know, you got to be okay with who you are, where you are at some points, and just relax and bask in the perfection that's you at this moment. That's when real peace happens, to step back and say, where am I now? Can I just enjoy the moment instead of chasing the better version of myself every day, basically?
It's a wonderful chaos, beautifully random, messy and glorious.
Solo or tandem?
We work to find rest, we fight to find peace, both head and the heart,
like a nephew and niece.
What are we doing here?
You mean listening to this show?
Where the more that you learn, the less that you know. Where the wounded are healers
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos.
Yes, today we have Ed Balta.
We have Ed Balta on. We're going to discuss with him how it feels to overcome stress. And when we look at him, which makes him so unique, he's been a doctor, an entrepreneur, businessman, two kidney transplants. So he has a lot of life history, and we're going to do that on
A Wonderful Chaos.
Before we go to Ed, you must be going through a little bit of stress at the moment with your new house.
With the new house, with Ronnie's work is a little bit up in the air, with selling this house. There's a lot of change. And what I noticed is when I have a lot going on, I get like this sense that I need to do something, and then there's nothing to do. So then I have to surrender, because I'm like, oh, I got to do something. And then there's nothing to do. So I've seen myself get caught up in this.
When you say nothing to do, you mean it's out of your control?
Not only out of my control, it's like, oh, I can only wait, or I can't do anything because it's decided. It's like almost like with your health, bodily health. Thank God I'm in good state. But at some point, you don't get to decide what your body does.
No.
We're renting this thing. So when I see this come up, it's like, oh, I want to take control, but I have to surrender because there's nothing I can do.
Mm. Yeah.
And I feel that coming up quite a bit. It happened with the book. You know, I sent out the third draft of, or the third book draft, and I got back. It wasn't panned. It wasn't horrible. But you know me, if people don't say I love it, it's the best thing I've ever read, then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I got to go give this a reevaluation.
Yeah.
And there was a bit of a helplessness in that, because how I wrote it and how I have to edit it are very different mindsets. I love writing. It's the most creative, energetic process. The editing puts me in a whole different state of mind that isn't kind of where I'm in flow. Mm. It's like very much more detail oriented and focused. It's not my joyous place. So that's also brought me a little bit of stress.
A little bit. Would you call it stress?
Yeah, I call it stress.
How does it feel in your body when you experience it?
It's a good... When Dad would yell at me as a kid, I lived in fear. And that fear turned into a background noise in my head. And I didn't know what life was like without that background noise.
You didn't know what life looked like without the background noise.
Yeah, it was like a buzzing sound in the back of my head.
Alertness.
It's not alertness. It's like a constant vibrating energy of anxiety, but it isn't given a place.
Okay.
And I remember we lived next to this, like it's called the 405 freeway. It was like the busiest freeway in the world. And there was like a white noise. And it was funny because that became silence for me, because the white noise was always there. So I didn't know that like white noise was like, oh, that's what silence is when nothing goes on. It's just a constant white noise. And in a way, stress was like that for me. It was this constant white noise. And so I remember freeing myself where it's just like all like serene quiet. So now when a moment like this comes up where I feel more of the stress come in, there's a higher contrast. Because before it was only stress, then it was like, okay, now I'm just sort of feeling really at peace with being. And now I'm starting to feel the stress come back again, but it's much louder because I feel the contrast with the quiet.
And you do have more quiet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, me going to Spain, living on the farm and separating from society quite a bit for, you know, an extended period, I'm going to get a lot of quiet and then we'll see what happens then. But that feels like one.
Oh, I'll fucking call you, Andy. I'll make sure that that your quiet is filled with.
Yeah. Andy, write this email for me. You haven't done that in a long time, have you? No. So, yeah, with that, I think it'd be nice to bring on Ed because, you know, he is the one who's going to share with us his experience with this. Hello, Ed.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Really stressed.
Yeah, Bambo's getting here. He was totally stressed. I didn't even mess with, I'm going to be late. Just he had the full on, you know.
No.
Okay, you weren't stressed.
No, of course not. I just said I'm late. Please be on time to receive the guest.
Oh, good.
Ed, you were late, by the way, but it's okay.
I'm so sorry. Technical difficulties. I had my first computer shut down on me, couldn't even get on. So I had to switch to my kid's laptop. So I'm on my kid's laptop right now. So
welcome to
technology Zoom meetings, basically.
That must have been really stressful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to get on and it's like, oop, no, battery's dead. And I'm like, oh my God, my kids were on it last night. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to use your computer now. So I'm on my kid's computer right now.
Well, it's lovely to have you, Ed.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
When I'm looking at the title of the show, Overcoming Stress, how is that even possible?
It's got to be possible, man. You cannot succumb to stress. I believe stress like paralyzes you and then eventually turns into fear. So it's not an option for me. It's a must for me. So I make it a must. I don't make it an option that overcoming stress is like, whether I want it or not, whether I like it or not, I'm going to overcome it and find a way to overcome it. Basically, it's part of life. It's going to happen whether you like it or not. I mean, life is stressful. Life is going to happen, but it's either you respond to it or you react to it. And I think once we react to it, that's when stress starts getting higher and higher because we're reacting rather than responding. And I like what Andy said about letting go, because a lot of it is letting go and giving it to the higher power, whatever you might think it is. You know, to me, it's God, but to other people, the universe or somebody else, that, you know, that you're not alone in this journey and it's okay. And it's all right to give it to somebody else and let go of control sometimes. And I think stress for most of us, at least for me, you know, it comes, and with the people that I've talked to, with my clients too, it comes to people that are overachievers, type A personality, where we like to control everything, entrepreneurs, always trying to be the best at everything, always trying to, you know, one step ahead and trying to be better every day. And then it gets to a point where it gets overwhelming. And that's when the stress level like starts going sky high, red zone, basically. And I think, you know, for me personally, you know, been an overachiever since I was young, been always trying to outdo myself, you know, what's the next step? What's the next step? And when you realize, okay, you know, you got to be okay with who you are, where you are at some points, and just relax and bask in the perfection that's you at this moment and enjoy that moment. Like Andy was saying, going on the farm and just being by yourself for a while and silence, that's when real peace happens. And I think for us, it's hard to stop sometimes and say, okay, I'm just going to enjoy this moment. And that was the biggest thing for me, is to step back and say, where am I now? Can I just enjoy the moment instead of chasing the better version of myself every day, basically?
out of all the topics you could be discussing with us today, so you're a doctor, an entrepreneur, yes. You've got two kidney transplants, and the topic that you've chosen to make important in your life is stress. So why with all that other story, is this the thing that you've taken on as the kind of mantle you carry in the world?
I guess for me, I don't know. I guess I equate more like stress and anxiety as like together, but I guess for anxiety, it's a little bit more because, that's what I deal with. That's who I help. That's who my clients are. People who are dealing with anxiety, overcoming anxiety. And, for a person that had anxiety, went through it, overcame it. And so I feel like it's a topic that more people need to talk about, like whether it's anxiety or stress. And I guess you could equate it, like you could say stress equals anxiety, but not really. But, you know, to that
point.
Do you have
a distinction between the two? Because mentally, oh, for sure. I think we all have it. Could you tell me what that distinction is between stress and anxiety?
Sure. For sure. Because in the beginning, I didn't really know until I went through it, man. You know, you could say I'm anxious, and that's fine. You're anxious. That's cool. Like, okay, yeah, I'm anxious because I'm stressed out. Like you said, Andy, about your house and buying the house. And that's a good anxiousness. That's like, that's a normal, like, that's an exciting thing. And you're excited about it, and you're stressed out about it because you got, but you can enjoy that process too, but still that's part of life and you're anxious about it and that's okay. But anxiety comes when really there's no danger and there's no like anything to be stressed about, yet your body is giving you signals that you're in fear, or like it's giving you signals that you should run and like, but there's nothing to run from. And you're like, I'm in my bed, I'm just laying here, but yet I'm getting heart palpitations, my cortisol levels is sky high, and I'm getting tingling down my arm, I'm getting tingling down my leg, and I got a headache. And all this just because I woke up. And when you get all these symptoms and you're like wondering, like, what the, like, I didn't, like, where am I? I'm in my bed, but yet a thought came by maybe like as soon as you woke up, and that thought triggered all this like, negative emotions of anxiety. So I think the distinction, the biggest distinction, is when you get the body sensations that last all day and with no known reason. Like, okay, you're stressing about buying a house. Well, I'm just sitting in my bed, but yet I'm getting the same amount of stress, if even more than you, because my anxiety is sky high, basically. And you have to be aware of that too. And when you get sensations all through the day and you're like, wait, I'm okay. There's no danger around me. Like, you have to check yourself and say, like, there's absolutely no danger around me. Why is my body giving me all this sensation of being in danger? Like, I have to run or I have to fly, basically. So that's the difference, I think, between the two, where one is like a direct response to something that's happening, whether it's, you know, something you have to think about, versus the other where nothing's happening, but yet you're getting the same response.
Yeah.
And you can't turn it off.
Yeah.
And you can't turn it off. And so when you can't turn it off the whole day, you're like RPMing.
Your cortisol levels are through the roof.
Wow. Yeah.
I have a question for you, because as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking of Bombos next to me. And I don't have a question for you. I'm sorry. I have a question for you, pointing the wrong direction. How is it when you hear Ed share this? Because I think of a lot about our journey together.
Well, I was thinking about last year when COVID hit, my business really suffered. And I was on full-on survival. And everything that I was doing was coming from fear. And it wasn't productive. I ran out of money. I just couldn't pay my bills. There was a lot of shame. And it really got to the point where I was tuning into, okay, do I call the doctor? Do I take medication? Like, this is serious. Like, I feel that I can end my life in this state. And I took it seriously to the point where, but I couldn't call anyone. Like, I looked at my phone. And I was scrolling for all the numbers on my phone, and I just didn't want to be a burden to anyone. And in that moment, I just sat down and I did breath work for 100 minutes.
Yeah.
And that really creates space from being here to dropping more in the body.
Right.
Not to mention that my legs were numb. So as you were talking in your introduction, you said it's a must to overcome it. And it made me curious. It's almost like you really were also in that survival mode.
Oh, yeah.
Can you share a little bit your story around the must?
Okay, so I'm going to go back. I'm 50 years old now. I just turned 50. So I'm going to go back to my first kidney transplant and how it came along, basically. And so I was 27 years old, lifting weights, bodybuilding. I had my business. Like I told you, I'm an overachiever. So I graduated chiropractic college when I was 24. I opened up my business when I was 25, had my own clinic, had my own employees. At 27, things are rolling. I going from college student to like owning your own business, having money now, and like having the freedom of like, okay, I got money now. I don't have loans anymore. I paid them off and I got all this money to use and everything. And then at 27, I'm in the gym. I'm trying to lift weights and I couldn't lift weights anymore. Like the weights were getting heavier, 25 pounds, which I used to warm up with. I couldn't even like lift them anymore. And I'm like thinking, what's wrong? You know, something is off here. And I know my body, I'm in tune with my body, and I studied anatomy. So I kind of like, okay, I understand. Like, I'm like, something is off. And so it went on like that. I'm like, okay, no, I need to go get a physical, And still, I get still choked up talking about this, but, I go to the doctor thinking, okay, I just have like maybe some anemia or something. Does the blood test comes out? It's okay, he says. And then he goes, like, you know, let's do an ultrasound of your stomach because it hurts a little bit. Does the ultrasound, comes back with another blood test. And then I'm in the hospital. Cut an hour later, she admits me to the hospital and says, your kidneys are failing. You cannot leave the hospital. So there you go. Going 60 miles per hour. Boom. Stop. Like, okay, you're going to be admitted in the hospital and you cannot leave and you cannot go back to work. And we need to put you on dialysis right away. And my world just went 360. It was like going, boom, like that's it. And I just could not believe it. And it was like, and I went through a period while I was in the hospital. I checked myself out because I didn't want to believe that I had that. I didn't believe her diagnosis. So I checked myself out against medical advice and I left. But a week later, I started getting weaker and weaker and weaker because the blood started getting dirtier in me because my kidneys weren't filtering. So I knew something was off. I was like, all right, you know, it is what it is. And I got to just face it. And went to the hospital, got checked in, started doing dialysis, which...
Slow down for me a little bit.
Mm. Yeah.
You left the hospital and then you go back. Like, I get emotional just hearing,
yeah.
Like you had a realization there.
Yeah, I had to face it, man. It was like, because I was getting weaker and weaker. I mean, I left the hospital, but I was just getting weaker. Like I could tell I was just getting weaker and I wasn't getting better. And it was denial. You know, you go through these, like whenever there's a trauma, you go through denial first, you deny it. And then you go through kind of like a depression mode and then you finally get through acceptance. And then you finally come out through at the end of it. But I had to go through that cycle where I denied it first and I left the hospital because I just didn't believe it. So I went to another doctor and they told me the same thing. Went to a specialist. They told me the same thing. So I was like, okay, it is what it is. Let's face it. Like, what's next? Yeah. Like, okay, what do I do now? Like, what's my next step? So basically took my business went from up here to like, whoosh, like that within the span of 3 to 6 months, I pretty much lost everything that I built because I was in the hospital so I can manage my clinic. And so I was like, this is like my life. And I went through depression, you know, I went through my depression mode and But I came out, and then I was like, okay, so when I was in depression mode, you know, I was a big, I still surf. And so my thoughts were like, all right, I could just go at the beach, lay a hammock out, and just at 27, just like pass away and end my life there. Basically, like, I didn't want to continue living anymore, because I just, in my mind, I couldn't comprehend how my life is going to be now with no kidneys, or being on kidney transplant, like with being so active and having my business and having all these dreams and hopes. So your mind just takes you places, and then you're like, oh, I could just be on a hammock and pass away. But then I'm like, oh no, I can't do that. I can't give up on life. So I was like, all right, we'll bite the bullet and start dialysis. And I don't know if you're familiar with dialysis, but it's 3 times a week, 4 hours a day of your day where you're hooked up to a machine. Your blood goes out, comes back in, and then it's cleaned, basically. But it drains you, man. I mean, that day, you're just shot. And I really had a hard time with it. So I went through a lot of hard days. And my business suffered, and my whole life suffered. I mean, when, again, like I said, going from 60 miles per hour to just dead stop. And then, so I was like, all right, I gotta, and there was a point where I was in the hospital and I kind of gave up. And then what happened is my whole health started declining, because I gave up. Like, I just mentally gave up. I was like, I'm done. I don't want to fight anymore. And I remember this one nurse came in one night, and I was like on the bottom, like I was at the bottom. And she goes, do you believe in God? And I said, yeah, I believe in God. And I said, why is God doing this to me? And then she goes, why not you? And that, when she just said, why not you? That kind of like flipped a switch in my mind. And then she goes, and then she gave me this elephant, and I still have it somewhere. And I don't know, it's been so long, but she gave me this elephant, and she goes, this is your good luck elephant, and I'm going to pray for you, and you pray with me. And she goes, don't give up. And from that day, like the next day, my numbers started getting better. Just that little hope that she gave me. And she said, you're a fighter, don't give up. And so the next day, my kind of like, I don't know what happened. I just call it a miracle. My numbers started getting better, like automatically. I didn't do anything different. And I think what Andy said, like just letting go. And I was just letting it go. And I gave it all to God. And then lucky for me, my mom was a match. So she gave me her kidney in 1998. And then I said, I will never let a day go by that I don't live it at 100%. Like I will not look at a day and say that this day was not worth it. Every day to me, I lived it like it was my last day of my life. Mm-hmm. And it turned into, it's a must that I must keep going on. And it's not a choice for me, because what I got is a gift, and I'm not going to let that gift go away, because my mom gave me one of her kidneys, and that means a lot to me. And that's what drove me to make it a must to keep going on, rather than, oh, it's an option. No, it's not an option. And every day is a gift, and I take it as a gift. I don't look at it as like, oh, it's just another day. I don't complain. I don't. Every day is like is a miracle to me. Mm-hmm. And that's how I say it's a must, not an option. I don't make it an option. Mm-hmm. It's like, you got to keep going.
Well, it's, your story really draws me in.
Yeah. When I tell it, I still get choked up, but I do have to share it, because it's just the tribulation of it. It's like, it was a roller coaster ride for me. And, you know, when I came back to work, my business like yours was zero. I mean, I was up, and then I told myself, I said, all right, now what? Like, I always just say, like, now what? Like, I don't go back and think about it. Like, I used to before, where I stressed out about it, but I'm like, or think about the past, because your brain wants to bring you the past and tries to fix it. But, like, there's nothing to fix. It already passed. So I'm like, now what do I do now? I'm at zero. Well, I started at zero before. So if I was able to do it once, I could do it again. And that's what I did, is I went through it again, basically.
Well, you mentioned that you share it and it chokes you up, but listening to you, I'm feeling you in that space. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
You said something really interesting, and it was a little bit like a paradox. You had two, I would say there were two types of letting goes. One was a giving up letting go, and the other one was the surrender letting go. And I never saw those two as a letting go. One is really I'm done, but it's not coming from a place of love. It's coming really from, what would you say?
I'm over this. Like, I'm done with this.
Yeah.
I saw the same. As you said it, I didn't articulate it, but I was a bit confused. When you said it was over, there was two overs, and the one is, I'm over, I'm ready to die. I'm over this. Let's. And then there's the surrender to whatever's meant to be is meant to be.
It's meant to be.
So how are those two connected in how you've shared? Because you did mention both of them a little bit differently, as far as I heard it. And I think you did the same.
I think when the difference is, one has like the bottom of the darkness and the other one has light in front of it. Like, there's hope. The darkness is like, okay, I'm done. Like, you know, I give up basically and I'm ready to go basically. Like, I'm ready to check out. And the other one is I surrender, but I know there's a light at the end of the tunnel here. And there's hope. And I think that's the two difference for me, basically. I saw both of them. Like, I experienced both of them, basically. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Actually, if I look at that, I often like to look at the world in terms of polarities. Mm-hmm. And the polarity that I often see, if I'm working with somebody, they'll come and they'll often say they haven't suffered enough to change the thing that they need to change for it to work. So it's like just inadequate enough that I want to do something, but not so much so that I'm going to put in the time and determination to really change the thing.
Yeah.
So I might spend the first few months of someone teasing the hell out of them until they finally say, okay, I'm done with this. And then it's the bottom that you're talking about, because they finally accepted they're going to change something. And then the surrender is, and whatever it is, I'm okay with it, because it's just going to be different. Yeah. That's really, really nice.
Yeah.
Where there's like hope and there's light versus like where it's like just darkness and you don't know where it's going to, like, you're just like,
yeah, but it's hard, because the one thing I've seen, especially when people try to switch things to be positive all the time, they've never fully embraced the dark and accepted it. And they're just trying to manage the dark. So they don't really say, okay, I'm over it. What they say is, okay, how do I make this better by putting a positive spin on something that I don't feel comfortable with?
Right.
So it's
or a numbing or an avoiding.
Yeah, numbing or avoiding. Yeah. It's clear,
Ed,
the other thing that hit me is you were sharing all the technical things that were happening to your body with the blood, what do you call it when they were taking blood out?
Transfusion.
Oh, dialysis. It's good. For kidneys, it's called dialysis. Yeah.
So what astonished me, there was no mental support, or at least you didn't talk about anyone giving you mental support. And somehow when you're busy with your body in that way, I didn't hear you sharing anything about someone supporting you mentally, like, hey, how are you doing? And I see you a bit puzzled what's happening for
you. So how to frame it into a question, how did you feel supported during that process?
Okay, so if... I'm going to be like really, really honest, like candid here, is I grew up in a Middle Eastern family. So we're tight. I mean, my support came from my family. And I'll be honest, if I didn't have that support, I think it would have been a way different story. But my support came from my mom, where God bless her, never left my hospital bed, not one day. I mean, I was there for 60 days. She was there for 60 days. She never left. And my dad, my brother, my sister, you know, they were always there for me. And my girlfriend at that time, now she's my wife, was there for me too. And so the support came from my family. If you had to ask me, like, was there support from outside? Like, no, there wasn't. But because of my upbringing and my family values, and because I'm Middle Eastern and in Lebanon, like, that's how we support each other. And we have a family, a tight family knit. We're not, our culture is very like different, and we stick together a lot. And so I think that helped me tremendously. And that gave me more of a reason, you know, to push through, basically. And you're right. If there was no support there, I think that would have been a harder journey for me, basically. Mm-hmm. So the support, but if you say like, does the whole journey of you being like on dialysis or anything like that, do you get mental support? I really don't know, because I don't know if it was offered to me at that point, but I really didn't need it because my whole family was there at that point for me.
Well, you mentioned that you don't need it, but in a way, what I heard you say was I was giving up. And then there was that moment where the nurse
caught,
like she felt into you. And
I was called her. She's like my guardian angel. No, it wasn't. I'm going to say like, mentally, I wasn't giving up. It was my body just gave up. Like, I don't know what happened. It's just my body just started declining. Like, they would do all these tests and they said, like, can't find what's wrong with you. But yet your whole, everything is declining on you, basically. And so it's hard to describe what happened, to be honest with you. But you're right. I mean, yeah, maybe I just needed that little push of hope. And that made a big difference. And that's what I do. What I do is because what we say, what we do sometimes, and what people hear, because a lot of people say, well, you know, you do all these things, who's listening to you? I'm like, if one person just listens and gets them over that, like a little bit push towards that hope, then I've done my job. And if I could help them get that, like just that little extra nudge, one word, one sentence, one episode or one paragraph that I said that could get them over that little hump, then I've done my job. And that's how I feel about what we do and what you guys do as well.
Act of love.
Yeah. And it just comes unselfishly and you know, and I guarantee you the nurse didn't know what impact she had on me, but yeah. She did, and it's just how it affected it, basically.
What I find nice, and I've heard Bambo speak about this as well, is in cultures that have tighter family units, where even intergenerational will live together in the same house traditionally, there's more of a sort of a structure of support that I see far more so than more westernized societies where there's a lot more independence. Right. You know, when I lived in Japan, grandma and grandpa lived with grandkids. They're all in the same house. And it's sort of, and I always felt that was so foreign to me, but I see obviously that there is a degree to which there's this family cohesion and support that comes with that.
Yeah. I'm from Cyprus, so I can swim to Lebanon.
I know, I was going to say, I've been to Cyprus.
I've got an important question, probably the most important. Where do you get a falafel as good as something you might get in Lebanon? Is it possible?
You said you grew up next to the 405, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I live next to the 405 too, because I'm in Huntington Beach, California. And where were you? What city?
I was like in Sherman Oaks. So like I'm like way, way away.
Okay, wait, you're in the valley then. Yeah. Okay, so but Glendale and Anaheim, what we call is like little Beirut or little Lebanon, basically, because that's where you don't even need to speak English over there. You go over there, you speak either Armenian or Arabic, and they got everything perfectly.
Look at that smile.
I have searched the world for the best falafel, and you know where the best falafel was as far as
I where do you guys live?
We're in Amsterdam right now. So we're in Amsterdam. Yeah, so we don't have a big Lebanese community. Falafels are hit and miss. There's some good ones, but none as good as the falafels I had in Sydney, Australia, which has a Lebanese community.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely incredible.
Yeah, the huge Lebanese community in there.
And don't try to move on to another subject
right now.
For
all of you watching, if you get hungry for Lebanese food.
I've had a lot of arguments with people who've told me that falafels are Lebanese, and then I speak to Israelis, and then they're arguing that, no, they're actually from Israel.
Are you done?
No, I'm not, Mamos. This for me is, these are the important parts.
He's trying to fish you.
Hey, when you talk about food, your serotonin goes up, your endorphins go up too.
I took the mic. Andy is no longer part of the show. Ed, the other thing which really hit me, if I may continue.
Please.
No worries.
You mentioned you were 15 when somehow this ambitious, overachieving, wanting to prove oneself began. Mm. Did it start then or did it start earlier, would you say?
I'm going to have to say probably a little bit earlier than that. And I probably have to say I equate it to my upbringing. I was firstborn. And as you know, in Lebanon, firstborn, you hold a higher mantle because, like, you're the face of the family, which I don't know what value that is, to be honest with you. And I don't know how much truth that is now versus before, because before they used to live on farms, so the oldest would inherit the farm. But we don't live in that world anymore. But anyhow, so it's like a lot of pressure on the firstborn kid, basically, like the boy especially. So you had to kind of like, your dad sets these like high marks for you and high standards. Like, this is how you act. This is how you're supposed to do things and everything. So even when I was younger, there was a lot more expected of me than my other siblings. And the reason being is like, I was first boy. And so you had to uphold the family name, uphold the family values, bless you, and make sure that you're always set, be the trendsetter and always doing well. And so with that, it got into like, it just, that's how I was raised. And so it just transferred into how I lived my life, basically, where it was always like, be the best, be the best, be the best, be the best, and always be the best. And then always act a certain way. But then the older I got, the more I was like, I need to back off this stuff, man. It's not healthy. It's like, I need to just chill out a little bit and be me rather than be somebody else that wants me, whoever they want me to be, basically act like somebody who they want me to be. And I don't want to do that anymore. And that took a while for me, but you know, it took a few hard falls on my face in order for me to finally say, okay, I need to chill out a little bit and just accept who I am and enjoy myself where I am rather than always chasing like, okay, be the better person, be the better, like, you know, what can I do to be better today? What can I do to be better? Like, how about you just relax one day and not be better? And then the next day, maybe try to get better a little bit. So that's where the upbringing, I think, came from.
And as Andy mentioned in the beginning, Cyprus is a very macho culture.
Yeah.
So I can imagine in Lebanon, it's the same.
Yeah.
It's a very masculine driven.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you fell on your face two or three times until you kind of had, okay, I need to back off a little bit.
Yeah.
If you had to guess, what was the event, what event hit you in the face hard in order to even allow yourself to have that thought?
I think when anxiety started peeking in and when anxiety symptoms and symptomology and all the body sensations started to sneak its way in there for me, I think that's what I knew. My cup is full and I got to start like emptying my cup a little bit and not keep putting so much pressure on myself and just enjoy life and just take a step back. I think that was like a, you know, my RPM was just going to red pretty much. I was rep, re, like pushing it a little bit too hard. I think also with the health anxiety, with the stuff that I went through and trying to control everything, you know, like, it's so funny because what Andy was saying is like, you know, trying to control your health. And then you're like, but wait, there's some stuff I can't control in my body. I just got to let go and just say, you know, it is what it is and it'll be what it'll be. And I'm just going to do my best and leave the rest up to God. Basically at that one point, you know, there's got to be a point where you just surrender and say, okay, no matter how much I think about this, it's not going to change the situation. Where before I would stay up all night trying to change the situation or trying to grab it and then try to like, okay, what can I do? What can I do? And it's like, now it's just like, you have to step back and say, there's really not, there's nothing to overthink. There's nothing to overanalyze. It will turn out okay. I'm just going to keep thinking positive and I'll accept whatever it is, what it's going to be. And Andy put it beautifully where he's saying like, I had to surrender. And it was, that's exactly how I felt. That's like, I had to surrender because it was just, that anxiety really, like when anxiety hit me, like that's what I call pop. It's like, okay, like accept who you are, man. Like fall in love with who you are. Stop like keep chasing like who you want to be. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you don't accept who you are and you don't like love who you are and then have that bank of love in you and have that currency of love in you, then you can't give love anymore. And you're just on empty, just trying to give love to everybody or trying to do stuff. But you're not going to get satisfaction from it. You're not going to enjoy it because you're always chasing. It's kind of like I always tell my clients and tell other people, it's like you want to get to see so bad that you forget that you enjoyed being there. And then once you get to C, you're like, oh, okay, is that it? Okay, let me go D now. And then so you never enjoy C, basically. It's always like constant, where's the next carrot like that I have to chase, basically, instead of sitting there like, let me enjoy A, let me enjoy B, let me enjoy C. And then maybe if I want to go to D, I'll go to it later. But let me enjoy that, where most people just don't do that. And I was guilty right there of being that.
So what you're telling me, Ed, you didn't actually, the kidney transplant was not the thing that slowed you down. It was later on where you became really sensitive to tuning into, okay, and now I need to slow down. And I'm wondering, like for me, where I am today, if I have a thought which is not serving me,
yeah,
my heart beats really fast.
Right.
And it's like my body has become a satellite for bullshit, bullshit thoughts. So I'll use that to get away from my desk or from what I'm doing and just slow down, go for a walk, lie on the ground, breathe.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering, how was that for you? And what kind of thoughts would actually, if anything, give you that like, oh, wow, I need to slow down now.
Very good. Very good. So through my anxiety journey, I developed OCD. And I'm not sure if you guys know OCD, like obsessive compulsive. So mine,
you know what I do for my wife? Like if she puts a dish somewhere, like I just move it 5 centimeters to the right or the left, just to like look at her face. So I live with OCD.
Now here's what I thought. The towels in the kitchen and I put them a little bit more messy.
So I thought that was the same thing. I thought OCD was just like, oh, it has to be neat. Everything has to be in order. I'm the opposite. I'm chaos. Like I don't like anything in order. I'm like totally opposite. Uh-huh. I'm like, you know, I like just what your title is. I like my office to be in chaos sometimes. But that's how I work. And so I was totally opposite. So I didn't know what OCD is. So anxiety and OCD is so different that I didn't like, I was not even aware of it. So basically OCD, pure OCD at least, is where your thoughts start taking over and you start getting you on the loop. Like it's just loops in your head where it's just that the same thought just loops in your head. And that thought just gives you anxiety the whole day, basically. It shoots up your anxiety and you cannot let go of that thought because your brain is so addicted to that thought. It's so addicted to overthinking, basically. And it's on automatic, like because you're reacting with fear, the brain just keeps sending you more thoughts of the same thing, whatever you're like afraid of, whatever you give attention to, basically.
And so, can you give an example of a thought before you continue? Like, what's a thought which really occupied you?
So,
give me the juice.
Like with pure OCD, like you get like intrusive thoughts. Like you get like bad things are going to happen, and it just loops in your head that it's just going to keep happening. Like what ifs, and it just keeps going. And then in the beginning, you think like you have to solve those what ifs, you have to answer those what ifs, and you have to kind of like get in the fight with all your thoughts. And so when you do that, that's where the compulsion comes, is that you take your thought, and then it's not the thought that's the problem. The thought is just going to pass by if you just let it. But what happens is the thought is coming, and then you jump up, and then you're trying to like wrangle with it, and you try to fight with it. And all day, it's just a constant fight with your brain, and you're never going to win because your brain will just take you down rabbit holes after rabbit holes. And that's what happens with OCD, is that you get stuck with what's called rumination, where you're just like all day long just thinking about that thought, and then you're trying to like solve it. But there's no solution because it's a bullshit, it's a bullshit thought. It's just a what-if thought. It's an unconscious thought that just your brain is just sending out on automatic, but you're entangling with it because you're thinking, if I solve this, my anxiety will go down. And it's not the truth. And it just keeps building, it just keeps feeding your anxiety. So you get into that loop where all day long you're thinking, oh, let me solve this. And then you solve this, and then your brain shoots another one at you. And then because it knows that you're going to react with fear, and then you're just going to keep going with that vicious cycle. So I went through that vicious cycle for a while, and it was hell, because you have one, if you think like you have one train of thought, think about like having five train of thoughts the whole day while you're trying to focus on work, while you're trying to focus on your family. I have four kids. And while you're trying to focus on your life and having fun, but yet in your mind, you're trying to solve all these problems where there's no solution, because what your mind does, it goes after things it cannot control. So there's actually no solution to it. The way I think about it is I wasted so much time of my life, like thinking of things that really didn't even matter. I should have just let them go. But in the beginning, you don't know. And then you start thinking that you are, and that's what anxiety does. It lies to you. So you think that you're your thoughts, but you're not your thoughts. Your thoughts are just coming in, passing by. The best way I could describe it, like the way I look at it now, is like your thoughts is like you watching a freeway and cars are just passing by, and you can either jump in there or you can just sit there and watch them. And if you can just separate yourself, and that's where the deep breaths come in, is you're separating yourself and you're just watching your thoughts, and you're saying, yeah, these are my thoughts, but I am not my thoughts, and let them just go. And your brain will just let them go automatically. But with OCD, it's a hell of a freaking disease. I mean, disorder, because I don't want to even call it a disease, but it's a disorder, because you get addicted to your thoughts, and you get addicted to trying to solve your thoughts where it never gets solved, basically.
It sounds like you were meditating without actually calling it meditating, just observing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to, because otherwise you get entangled in there. Just like you said, like you have to pull back, go for a walk, call a friend, solve a puzzle, because your brain wants to solve something. And so you solve something, or you go walk, and then get your, get on mindfulness, basically. Like you said, present time mindfulness. But that's what anxiety is. I mean, anxiety and OCD is just all living in the future. And as much as you can, you try to bring it back. But it's hard, because when you have anxiety, it makes it feel so real. Like these thoughts don't look like just thoughts. They feel like it's happening to you, because your body thinks like it's happening now. So your body is at a 10 in anxiety, and you try to logically, to comprehend those thoughts. It never works. It's a logical thought, so you cannot argue with it. You just got to let it be, and eventually it'll pass away. But it's easy. I always say, recovering from anxiety is simple, but it's not easy, because it takes a lot of practice. And like you said, meditation, deep breath work, and everything like that, which is part of my rituals every day. I'll tell you, having bullshit in your mind to deal with versus like having real things, like real, yeah. like, oh, my computer's not working. Well, at least it's real versus in your mind where it's all imaginative. So being in a fake reality and trying to handle your emotions in a fake mm-hmm. illogical reality versus having a logical, I'll yeah. take a logical day any day.
What happens is when you've made so much peace with so much adversity, yeah. all of a sudden life is as it is. And if there's less stuff, then it says, okay, apparently there's just less stuff. Now, I'm in a luxury position, so I don't want to pretend for a moment. Unlike Bambos, he actually was worried the electricity might be turned off, sort of
right,
feeling.
That's why I said I'm sensitive to everybody yeah. that went through the, you know, because my business got hit too.
Yeah.
And, but I knew even if my business gets hit, that I could always bounce back up. I've been at zero before.
Yeah. There's one thing we didn't discuss, which I think was a big topic that we didn't touch on, and it was sleep. I see sleep deprivation has a bigger impact on my clients' mental state and therefore the stress and anxiety than probably any other factor that I know of, at least in my work. Like they might 100%. Have a really bad situation, but without sleep, they can't look at it with clear eyes.
So I'm going to go back a little bit and then I'll wrap it up. When I was going through anxiety, and a lot of anxiety sufferers go through this, it affects your sleep. Like, especially with OCD, it won't let you sleep because you're thinking so much. You're trying to solve so much in your head that you can't even solve it. And then, so you stay up trying to solve it and then fear kicks in and then you can't sleep. Once fear kicks in, good luck. You get your adrenaline, you get your cortisol at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then you're like, what do I do now? So I had to go to the gym sometimes to get them out because it's like, it's there. Well, you get to a point where you're like, okay, I recognize that sleep is important. I'm going to do my best. Even if it's during the day, if I have to rest, I will give my, I'll give my body permission to rest. And that was hard for me because I've never taken naps before. And it got to a point where it's like, I need a nap. I will take a nap to reset. Just like a computer needs to reset, I'm going to reset myself. And so now if I need a nap, I will take a nap. Where if you ask me 5 years ago, take a nap, I'll be alone. Naps are for losers. Naps are for like people that are not overachieving, not going for it, basically.
Oh, whereas sleep like, when I'm dead.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Forget that. Uh-huh. I sleep a lot now. As far as sleeping, what helped me the most is the meditation, listening to meditation, listening. In the beginning, I couldn't meditate, like just meditate. There was way too many things in my head. So I had to do guided meditations, and that helped me out a lot. And also, I believe you create your own reality. And I know I'm going off tangent here, but I wrote down how I wanted to sleep, like how I really wanted to sleep. Like I kept writing down how it is right now and how I want it to be. And I kept meditating on that and kept praying on that. Like, this is how I want it to be. I'm sick of doing this now. And I want it to be this way. And I just kept writing how I want it to be, how I want my sleep to be, how many hours it's going to be, what time I'm going to go to sleep, and then how I'm going to wake up in the morning. And I kept writing this down. And eventually it created it in my mind too. And my mind accepted it. My subconscious accepted it. And it took a while, but it accepted it. And then finally it became like, okay, this is what we do at night. I've done enough. I'm good. You did good. And I always write, I have like a little thing next to me where I write down my thoughts, and it's like an eraser kind of like thing. You write it down, you can push a button and it erases everything. And then you keep writing. But at the end of the night, before I go to bed, I will say you did good. And I feel like that's an exclamation mark for me. And I'm like, that's it. There's nothing more. You know, whatever your nightly ritual is, whether it's tea, whether it's just calming down, reading a book or something, calm yourself down. I know they say never to like get on your phone. I like watching funny stuff at night just to get, you know, the serotonin leveled up. Like you're laughing, your hormones are on a good vibe, and then you're ready to sleep. But then again, I work out a lot and I'm always active. So by the time night comes, I'm always tired anyways. I mean, I either surfed like 3 hours in the morning, or I went and played, you know, pickleball or soccer, or I'm at the gym. So I'm spent by the time the night comes. Yeah. So But that's important. I think writing down how your reality is and what you want it to be is so important. That's been such a game changer for me.
I love it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Ed. Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome.
It was great being with you for the hour and a bit.
Oh, man, you guys are awesome. Thank you for giving me the forum and letting me be vulnerable here. Yeah. And that was one more thing is like I had such a hard time being vulnerable in the beginning. I'm not an open person, but I realize all the people that helped me, if they weren't not vulnerable, I wouldn't be where I was. And so I have to be vulnerable and just and let my emotions out and then just be okay with my story, basically.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys. I really appreciate your time with me.
I enjoy the sort of feeling into the anxiety as this constant state, which is there even when the stimulus isn't. When he said that, it was like, oh, yeah, that's a great way to see it as I could feel it. It wasn't just a concept. Yeah. Nice.
When someone shares their story, that in a way they're reliving it. And of course, I was also feeling it, reliving my own stuff as you were sharing. So at some point I had to take a few deep breaths myself to like, oh yeah, I'm here. I'm not.
Yeah. My kidney is functioning. Okay. Oh yeah.
In Chinese medicine, they actually say the first organ that gets messed up, if you are under any stress, it's your kidneys, which is your life force. It's your sexual energy. So they really emphasize on
the kidney,
sending love to the kidneys. Very delicate, the size of your ears.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So.
We're going to see you tomorrow.
With that, we see you tomorrow. And where will we see these wonderful people?
On A Wonderful Chaos, Mr. Shalev.
It's a wonderful chaos.